Greetings, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that unquestionably challenges you to think outside the box of convention and to explore with me and my great guests the many other possibilities available in the free thought zone. That's where we will journey to today during the program. Everything is available to us. No holding back. We are not mainstream. We are the alternative truth. And thank you for being part of the truth. So stay tuned. Here we go. Get ready for another hour of out there information.
Great, and out there it is indeed. Hi, everybody. This is Patricia Corey. I am speaking to you from the Azores Islands, where it's 4 in the morning. So you can imagine that I am definitely excited about being awake at this time of day and just to bring you the show at 9 p.m. California time. And I have really got a great show for you today. I have an author on who's been with me before. He blew my mind that time, and I know he will again, because this is a unique author. He has a really interesting slant what's going on this planet. He is originally from England, and his name is Nick Redfern. He's now living in the States. He's a full-time author and journalist specializing in a very interesting range of unsolved mysteries. UFO, Bigfoot, alien contact, of course. The Loch Ness Monster, conspiracy, you name it, he writes about it. He's a regular writer for UFO Magazine 14 times, Paranormal Magazine, and Fate. He has several books out. His previous books include Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, Strange Secrets, A Covert Agenda, and There's Something in the Woods. Ooh! Among his many exploits, Redfern has investigated reports of aliens in Mexico. I had him on for that, if you remember. Lake monsters in Scotland, vampires, and chupacabras, what we discussed the last time, as I recall. And, of course, UFOs and that whole vast subject. And today we're going to be talking about his book, Monster Files. So please welcome Nick Redfern. Hiya, Nick.
Hey, Patricia. How's it going?
It's okay. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I remember last time my hair was standing on end by the end of the conversation. So we're going to dive right in. I want to talk about, find time to talk also about Men in Black, which is a subject that's very interesting to me at the moment. So we're going to talk about, we've got more than an hour today. So if you've got the time, as I say, I've got the beer. So let's talk about, first of all, this latest work, Monster Files. What is this? How did you get to this?
Well, Monster Files basically it falls into the field of what's called cryptozoology. And cryptozoology is the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot or the Abominable Snowman or lake monsters, sea serpents, things like that. And I've written about 7 or 8 books on cryptozoology altogether. And nearly all of those are written sort of from the first-person perspective, like a road trip style. But this one's a bit different because it deals with an aspect of cryptozoology, which hasn't really been touched upon before. And that's what government agencies know about the subject. And I use the Freedom of Information Act of various countries a lot to get files released from the relevant agencies. And over the years, I've heard rumors of official interest in strange creatures. So I started filing requests, and to my sort of surprise, and I was very pleased, the fact that a lot of these files have now started to surface, and they sort of tell a fascinating story that actually goes back more than 100 years of official military and government interest in sightings and encounters involving weird animals and animals that science really doesn't recognize as existing.
Well, I'm surprised because, you know, the idea of any more freedom of information is hard to believe that you're still able to acquire information unless, of course, they want it out. What is your opinion about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, all the files in the book are documents that have legally and officially been declassified by the relevant agencies. So it was a case of me filing a request, and then, you know, you wait for the agency to review the documents to let you know whether they will permit it to be released or not. And, you know, I was very pleased that in many cases, they, or most cases, they actually did declassify the files.
What was the most shocking piece of information you received, considering your vast knowledge about the subject?
Well, I think more than anything else, it was sort of the sheer weight of reports and number of reports involving military personnel where, for example, there were a lot of reports where sailors on battleships and where the entire crew and even the captain had reported seeing creatures like sea serpents in the Atlantic Ocean, which were described as literally in the official files as like 300 feet long, you know, which is, it sounds like something straight out of a horror film until you realize these are official government records that have, you know, were previously classified and they're only now beginning to surface. But, you know, when you get something like that and you've got like an extensive, lengthy dossier of reports that in the sea serpent case, this is actually a 50-year long file. It covers literally a 50-year period, and it's packed with reports where sailors had seen these vast sort of serpent-like giant snake-type creatures in the Atlantic, and in some cases, they were within about 200 feet of the creature, so they could clearly see what it was, and they were all unanimous that it seemed to be a creature that, ironically, was actually longer than the ship. That's how they were able to determine its size. The ship itself was like 200 feet long, and the creature was longer than that. So, you know, that sort of amazed me. Everybody's heard of sea serpents, but it's not often you realize that, you know, they're the subject of government files, and where you have the testimony of something like 150 people.
That really fascinates me. It's such a British thing. I wonder, in the case of the sea serpents, is this does this cross nationalities, or do you find that some stories or some experiences are particular to a certain culture?
Well, some of them are typical to a certain culture purely because of where the, you know, this is the regional and geographical areas where the creatures are seen. You know, for example, Bigfoot is seen in the United States, and you have the abominable snowman in the Himalayas in Tibet. So, you know, you're not going to see the Bigfoot in Sweden or somewhere, you know. So a lot of it is geographical, and of course, depending on the location, then for the most part, it's going to be people who are sort of relevant to that particular area, yeah.
Okay, so, boy, I don't know where to start. I do recall some time ago you were on the show, and you took us on a shocking journey into the story of Chupacabra, and your experience there about that was just amazing. So I'm hoping that in the hour you'll be able to tell us also about some of your personal experience with some of these things, and I'm particularly interested in Bigfoot. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I've been on a number of Bigfoot expeditions over the years. Everybody thinks of Bigfoot, and they think, you know, it's just a North American creature. Now, in terms of the name, you know, Bigfoot is, you know, a definitively American term. But all around the world, you can find reports of strange creatures that sound just like Bigfoot, you know, like a large, hairy, humanoid creature, anywhere from sort of 6.5 to about 9 feet tall. Now, everybody knows probably the most second famous creature like this, which is the abominable snowman or the Yeti of the Himalayas. But in the forests of Australia, they have their own version, which is known as the Yowie, and there's also a Chinese version called the Yeren. And you can find, even in Europe, where I'm originally from, you know, they have ancient stories of wild men in the woods. So you can find stories like these everywhere. And I've been on a lot of expeditions for these creatures, and I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, you know, that they exist. I don't know what they are, but, you know, people see them, people report them, we get very credible reports. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize They think today that the world is well-traveled and completely, totally, 100% explored, which actually isn't the case. I mean, a lot of the forests of the Pacific Northwest of the United States, you know, those forests are hundreds and hundreds of square miles, and hardly anybody goes into them. You know, you get sort of 15 or 20 miles off the highways. You know, you're just in dense forests where nobody goes. So it's not out of the question at all. You know, that people would see these things.
Have you ever seen anything?
I haven't, unfortunately. I mean, I've found things like footprints. I've got sort of plaster casts of footprints, you know, which are sort of all, like the length of a human foot and half as long again. And when you find these, you know, in dense forest area, then you realize, and you stumble upon them, then it's really hard to sort of reconcile that with the idea of a hoaxer. You know, what with the point of somebody just going out 30 miles into the woods, stomping around with some fake footprints, just in the hope that one day, or, you know, soon, somebody's going to also trek 30 miles into the woods in the right direction, just happen to find them, you know. So that, to me, that rules out hoaxers. But yeah, I've got things like that. But, you know, footprints, and particularly at night, hearing occasionally, you know, sort of strange noises that don't sound like, for example, bears or coyotes or anything like that. That's probably the closest I've come. But, you know, my view has always been that if we're going to find these things, you've got to go on the expedition. So hopefully one day, you know, one of the expeditions will prove to be 100% positive. You know, we'll get more than the footprints or whatever.
That we deny these things just blows my mind, considering thousands of experiencers who bring very credible information to the field.
Well, unfortunately, what happens often is that, you know, you get scientists who, a lot of scientists, unfortunately, you know, are sort of very much driven by ego, that they know everything. And, you know, they'll say, well, there's just no way this can exist because we haven't found it, you know, which is kind of like an illogical argument. But they don't go out looking for these things. You know, I've had this experience where they said, well, it couldn't exist. And then I said, well, have you actually gone looking for it? And they're like, well, no, you know. So that kind of, you know, annoys me when somebody makes such a proclamation and then they follow it up by saying they haven't even bothered to look into it, but they know it can't be real. So that's what we're up against. But yeah, people just don't realize, you know, that like South America. I mean, South America is just, you know, dominated by vast rainforests and jungles. And, you know, unless you have reason to be there, most people just don't go into these places. So, you know, when you, as I said, in the United States, I mean, you get a few miles outside of Seattle, you know, you're in thick forest land, and you can walk for like 2 or 3 days, and you know, you're still in thick forest. You're not even out of it, you know.
Oh yeah, you can even get lost in the forest and not find your way out.
I mean, they're gigantic. I mean, they are literally hundreds and hundreds of square miles. We're not talking about, you know, a 10 miles square mile area of woodland. We're talking literally hundreds of square miles, you know, like 150 by 80 miles or something of just heavily thick forests.
Yeah, it's like people denying the UFO phenomenon and saying there's no such thing, or I've never seen anything, and I remind them that usually by 9 p.m. they're snuggled up in their house. And this phenomenon, you know, I've been out, I go out here, and I'm on the Azores Island, beautiful starry view, and I see a lot of activity out there, but I'm looking for it. So, duh.
Well, that's it. You know, most people, I mean, most people who see things, you know, aren't necessarily, you know, in the right place at the right time. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, scientists just sitting in a, you know, in a stuffy office or whatever, they're not going to see anything. That's why we get a lot of good reports from, for example, like police officers, because they're the people who are, you know, if they're on night duty and they're sort of patrolling the roads or the forests or whatever at 10 or 11 o'clock at night or 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, they're more likely to see something than everybody else. So I think a lot of that comes into it as well, that you have to be in the right place at the right time. And unfortunately, a lot of people, just due to circumstances, aren't largely in the right place at the right time.
Right. What you write about Theodore Roosevelt and his connection with Bigfoot. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, Theodore Roosevelt, the U.S. president, he had a big, deep interest in wildlife and outdoors and hunting and things like that. And in the latter part of the 19th century, he was given a story by a colleague of his named Bowman, which essentially, if you look back at it today, it sounds very much like an early Bigfoot-type report. Now, the term Bigfoot itself, the word itself, I should say, actually wasn't created till the 1950s, and skeptics have said, well, you know, there were no reports before the 1950s. Now, there certainly weren't any reports where people called it Bigfoot, because they said that's when the name was created. But you can go back and look into 19th century newspapers where they talk about hairy wild men of the woods in the Pacific Northwest woods. And you can go back to Native American times when the first British settlers came over, and they talked about hairy giants living in the forests and on the mountains. So they're clearly, to me at least, talking about the same creature, but, you know, just the name itself has changed over the years. Now, Roosevelt's story goes back, as I said, to the latter part of the 1800s, and he was given this story by a friend named Bowman, who was a hunter, who was actually out in the Pacific Northwest woods, and with a colleague who was actually killed under very violent circumstances by what sounded like some sort of, like a large savage animal. Now, you know, the first thought for people might be, well, perhaps it was a mountain lion or something like that. The problem with that theory is that when they found the body of his colleague, which had got sort of like vicious bites to his neck and his neck was broken, they found large footprints in the area, but it was clear from the expert trackers who were looking at the prints that the creature walked on two legs. You know, it wasn't a four-legged animal. Now, bears certainly can walk on two legs, but they only do so very, very seldomly. You know, they run and walk primarily on four legs, but they can stand on the hind legs, you know, to look over sort of high ground and things like that. But they certainly don't run or walk exclusively on two legs. So there shouldn't really be anything like that in the United States except, you know, human beings. And the footprints are far larger than any human prints. And so that was sort of a puzzle. But retrospectively now, if we look back at it, you know, when you've got somebody deep in the woods killed quite violently, what looks like by a wild animal, and all you find are two-legged prints, and they're gigantic footprints, you know, that for me is a clear indication of something like Bigfoot. Now, the good thing is that in the vast majority, I would say like 99.9% of all reports, we don't find any evidence of sort of hostile activity, you know, where somebody is killed or anything like that. There are only maybe two or three stories like that covering, you know, sort of 300 or 400 years. There are reports where these creatures have reportedly, you know, tried to intimidate people by, you know, issuing sort of savage calls and growls in the woods and throwing rocks and that kind of thing, but not actually killing a person. But that said, you know, you often find that occasionally an animal will go as rogue, as they call it. And, you know, it's like occasionally you get a man-eating tiger, but, you know, the other tigers have this sort of innate, although they could, you know, kill a person on sight, they have this sort of innate angle where they really don't. You know, they just go for smaller animals. So it's not impossible that occasionally you might have, like, a rogue Bigfoot. And the mere fact, you know, that the story actually reached the president, that was one of the reasons why I included it in the book, was, you know, to demonstrate that if you're talking about government and official interest in Bigfoot, it doesn't get much higher than, you know, the office of the president.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Okay, yeah, I'm surprised to hear that. I've never heard of a violent tale about Bigfoot. I've always, my experience is always that it's been a shy being, or that it tends to just, you know, it obviously from the more popular footage we've seen, He seemed to always be elusive and escaping, almost fearful in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of the reports are of a creature that, sort of keeps itself to itself. I mean, most apes, you know, whether you're talking about gorillas or chimpanzees, you know, most of them live in families. They live in large groups. And unfortunately, that's why it's why they're so, gorillas particularly, are now, you know, on the endangered species list, because they're so easy to find because they live in such large groups. But Bigfoot, if it is a giant ape, is distinct from all the other giant large apes in the sense that it doesn't live in groups. They're nearly always seen solitary, which is sort of completely different. Now, there are some Bigfoot reports which almost have like paranormal overtones to them, where people have reported seeing the creature sort of vanish in a flash of light or fade away, as if some people think it could be like some sort of an interdimensional thing. And there have been reports of Bigfoot seen at the same time and same location as UFO activity and strange lights in the woods. So, you know, I'm not personally convinced that Bigfoot is just an unknown ape. I think, you know, we need to sort of look at these weirder aspects more, and possibly they might explain why it is so elusive, if it is able to sort of perhaps flit in and out of our reality, and it's something far weirder and far more significant than just like a North American unknown ape, if you like.
Well, like you said, the fact that it occurs in other civilizations as well, other societies, is also very interesting. And, of course, we've got the Yeti in Tibetan lore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Tibetans, the Tibetan monks, they have like a long history and folklore as well of the creatures having sort of magical properties. And again, that they were sort of like, they were creatures that could exist in like our physical realm and almost in like a spirit realm as well, you know, as if they could flit in and out of our reality. And it's interesting that you had that belief there, and you have that belief with the Native Americans as well. They believe that the creatures existed, but they believed also that they were something almost like magical, if you like, you know, in simple terms. So I think there are far larger questions to be asked about Bigfoot that go beyond just like a zoological mystery.
Most definitely. Does the U.S. government have bodies of these beings on ice?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is an interesting angle. It's kind of like the cryptozoological equivalent, excuse me, of, you know, talking about the Roswell alien bodies. You know, there are a lot of stories about dead aliens stored away in military bases, and we have similar stories about Bigfoot bodies. And I've got a couple of chapters in the book about, you know, claims that military agencies have found the bodies of Bigfoot and autopsied them, etc., and, you know, and they're in frozen cryogenic storage in military bases. And certainly the most sort of enduring and lasting stories relate to the volcanic eruption on Mount St. Helens in Washington State in 1980. And what happened was that in May of 1980, Mount St. Helens, it had been rumbling for several months, and it was a clear indication that there was going to be some sort of volcanic eruption, which actually did occur in May 1980. And the mountain, when it erupted, the sort of plume of ash and dirt and dust that rose into the sky, I mean, it literally rose thousands of feet. And horizontally, the blast from the mountain actually was recorded as traveling at 250 miles an hour. You know, that gives you some idea of the speed of the wind blast. And unfortunately, somewhere in the region of like 60 people who refused to leave their homes because they didn't think it was going to happen were literally vaporized. You know, they were killed instantly. And we also know a lot of animals were killed, somewhere in the region of 1,000 elk and, you know, tens of thousands of smaller animals. It was just like it was almost like a small atomic explosion almost.
Yes, it was.
And, you know, military agencies and emergency services came in to not just help the people, but, you know, help rescue injured animals. And local military bases came in. And since that period of 1980, right through till literally last year, we now have the testimony from somewhere in the region about 15 or 16 retired military people who have said that they were either aware of or were directly involved in the recovery of a number of Bigfoot corpses that, you know, that were killed supposedly when the mountain erupted and there was this huge blast. And there are stories about people talking about loading these sort of large ape-like bodies into secure nets, which were then attached to large helicopters, and, you know, and they were taken up into the sky to the nearest military base for autopsy. And, you know, if we just had one or two of these stories, we could perhaps write them off. Or if they were all exactly the same, you know, you could say, well, it sounded like they were colluding, you know, just to tell the story. But what's interesting, we have different people talking about it from their own perspectives, which actually adds weight to it, you know, because they're telling, you know, from somebody was on the base, somebody was in the helicopters, that kind of thing. So when you put it all together, we have an undeniably controversial story, but a fascinating one as well, suggesting that maybe anywhere from sort of 5 to 10 of these creatures were found, and maybe not all of them even dead, maybe one or two sort of severely injured that were rescued. Now, you know, where they are now, today, if the bodies still exist or, you know, even the living ones, we just don't know. But we have a lot of testimony about the bodies being taken from the mountains. So I think in that sense, you know, there's a story there where we've got part of it. But unfortunately, we've sort of hit the brick wall as to, you know, where the evidence might be held, if you like. But, you know, I think over time, hopefully, we'll get more of this story and be able to put more of the pieces together.
That's fascinating. Why? Okay, you know, I'm obviously asking a rhetorical question, but why does everything have to be held secret? Surely the information of Bigfoot and the verification of a species should be something that we're allowed to hear about. Unless,
well,
of course,
yeah, the thing is, nobody hid the evidence when we found gorillas or chimpanzees, you know, or tigers. There was nothing secret about that. So if there is a large degree of secrecy surrounding Bigfoot, you know, if Bigfoot was just a North American ape and nothing else, you know, that science hadn't found yet, I don't think there would be any reason to hide it. I think it would just be a zoological discovery and it would be announced in the same way, you know, that the Congo gorilla, when that was found, it was announced. So
right. My
personal view is I think there has to be, I think it's connected to this issue of how there seems to be like a paranormal aspect to Bigfoot and possibly a
right. Tie-in
with UFOs. And, you know, the UFO subject we know is subject to national security issues. So for that very reason, if there's a suspicion that Bigfoot is part of that mystery as well, I think that's why it's being covered up, because there is no logical reason why, you know, the existence of just an animal that science hasn't found yet should be hidden by the government. There's no reason at all. It's just not logical, unless there's like a spin-off thing that ties it in, you know, with the UFO phenomenon as well. So I think it's got to be something like that.
Yeah, that or, of course, some sort of interest in the genetic structure, the potential of some kind of a Frankenstein situation.
Well, you know, one of the things that some people have suggested is that maybe the government is hiding the truth about Bigfoot, because when they've autopsied these creatures, they found they're actually closer to us than the apes. And then that would sort of open up a lot of doors to, well, if they're a type of very primitive human, then does that mean they should have rights and regulations? And, you know, does that mean the forest should be closed off to everybody because, you know, there's another form of human lives there? And then, you know, that would open up all sorts of different avenues with the religious angle, you know, where people talk about, you know, there are some people who don't believe in evolution, some people who do. If you then reveal that, well, it's another type of human living in the U.S., which isn't Homo sapiens, but it's a more primitive form, then
you
have all those doors and controversies opening. So maybe one of the reasons is, you know, because of the biology of the creature, that something's been found that is controversial there, and that might be, you know, a reason why it's been hidden as well.
Yeah, the so-called missing link. All right, everybody, if you've just tuned in, you are listening to Beyond the Matrix with my fascinating guest, Nick Redfern. We're talking about his book, Monster Files. We're talking about, you know, many of his books, I'm sure, but his latest book is Monster Files. His website is nickredfern.com. And prepare yourself for another half an hour or more, if he's got the time, of just exciting
so
information.
Maybe somebody's just said, this is just going to be easy, you know, just to keep it under wraps because it's too controversial.
I think it might be a little bit of all of those points, and how the scientists are berserk on DNA, I would imagine if the government had come across a species like this, they would certainly be doing some very interesting experiments with the DNA of this creature.
Oh, yeah, and maybe they have, you know, and perhaps, you know, they've uncovered something about that DNA that has surprised them and shocked them. And
yeah.
I mean, sometimes science does that. I mean, you know, scientists are supposed to be about revealing this and opening up about this. But often we've seen in the past that, you know, when something's uncovered where it sort of challenges the accepted version of events, then it's often denied. You know, when people come up with new ideas for how the pyramids or Stonehenge may have been built, if it doesn't go along with the accepted scientific scenarios, you know, the scientists are like, well, no, that's nonsense. We know how this was built, or we know how that was done. You know, they don't like their sort of status quo challenged.
Right, and then, of course, a lot of the scientists are funded by the military, and I wanted to ask you, can you explain how the U.S. Air Force was involved in the Bigfoot situation back in the 70s?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. This actually comes from a friend of mine named Stan Gordon. And Stan, from the early 70s onwards, did a lot of Bigfoot research in the state of Pennsylvania, where he still lives. And in 73 and 74, there were a lot of reports coming through, particularly in sort of rural, heavily wooded areas of Pennsylvania, of people seeing Bigfoot-type creatures. Particularly late at night, and where these creatures were seen around farmland and forests, etc. And Stan, because he does like a lot of radio, and people, you know, word got out that this is the person to report them to, he got a lot of reports when there was this massive wave of sightings going on. But what was interesting is that he wasn't just getting reports of Bigfoot. People were seeing strange lights in the sky at the same time, and literally above the forest.
Wow. Well, that certainly weaves in the UFO factor. All right, well, hopefully my producer has noticed that Nick's line has dropped. Okay, you can hear me, Nick?
Yeah, I don't know what's happened. I guess the men in black are intruding on me. I don't know. I'm on a regular landline, so I don't know what the... Maybe
well, let me just suggest that it's been my experience over the 7 years that I do this show that when I touch a nerve, which is probably almost every week, inevitably something goes kafooey with the lines. I'm used to it, so the important thing is to march on, as they say.
There you go.
Okay, I've got to just get my mind around where we were. We were talking about, I think we're done with that question.
Oh, with the military and Bigfoot.
Yeah, the military,
like
that's the nerve I was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we don't see certainly any evidence of like military agencies taking an interest in every Bigfoot case under the sun, or certainly most of them, you know, if it's just a regular sighting. But they seem to pop up intriguingly when somebody says they saw Bigfoot and it sort of vanished in the light, or it just faded away, or somebody else reported a UFO encounter over the woods at the same time. Then we see sort of quiet questions being asked by military agencies. And so I think they understand there's a pattern at work here. I don't actually think they have all the answers, because if they did, there'd be no need for these questions to be asked of the witnesses for sort of 20 or 30, 40 years. You know, Stan Gordon was being asked by government people, you know, 40 years ago, you know, can you keep us informed? And I still get reports like this today where somebody's had a very weird Bigfoot experience and then somebody from the military or an agency of government has knocked on the door and said, hey, you know, can you spare a few minutes to talk about your encounter? So they're clearly still trying to collect data, I think, and probably still trying to understand and figure out exactly what's going on.
That's very exciting. That aspect of it is just so... so timely at this time where we're really starting to see some openings in disclosure. Let's hope that more emerges.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, that's one of the things that pleased me about the book was that, you know, as I said, whenever I use documents in the book, I only use sort of freedom of information stuff and documents that have surfaced legally, you know, and lawfully through government agencies. And that's what, you know, that pleased me about doing this research is that the relevant agencies, whether it was in the US, in the UK or Australia, they open their books, so to speak, on these monster files. And, you know, I got literally hundreds of pages of everything from Bigfoot to sea serpents, the Loch Ness Monster, the Abominable Snowman, Australian equivalents. You know, there's the files were just, you know, there weren't really many deletions in the files either. It was, you know, just everything was in the file. It was declassified. Now, certainly in saying that, you know, we haven't had anything obviously declassified on Bigfoot autopsies or bodies. So I think it's like with the UFO subject. You know, we've got some interesting documents, but the real hard evidence, you know, we're still not getting access to that just yet.
Okay, but tell us what you know about the Flatwoods Monster of 1952.
Well, yeah, the Flatwoods Monster is an intriguing story because this also attracted government interest. Now, Flatwoods is a little town in West Virginia, and in 1952, in the summer of 52, there was a huge wave of UFO sightings across the United States, and they sort of culminated in 2 weekends worth of sightings in Washington, D.C., where military planes were scrambled and these objects were tracked on radar, etc. But there were still sightings in the immediate months afterwards, like August and September. And in September 52, you had this weird event in Flatwoods where a number of the people in the town saw this strange light come sort of shooting over the town, and they believed it came down in a large area of forest, like on a hilly part of the outskirts of town. So a number of people went out there, and they came across this, the way you can only really describe it, was like a 12-foot-tall humanoid type thing, sort of glowing, had these glowing eyes, and it almost looked like electric sparks and static coming off it. So the way it was described, it kind of sounded like almost like a cross between a giant robotic type creature and some sort of monstrous animal. And it's never really been repeated since, you know, almost like a one-off type encounter. And not surprisingly, the people who saw it charged off back down the hill. You know, they didn't wait around to find out what it was. And, of course, a lot of questions are being asked as to what this might have been. What's interesting is that there's actually a file on this at the National Archives in Maryland. It's actually filled with, like, newspaper reports and magazine articles put together during that particular period by newspaper journalists, but also by some of the early UFO researchers. But the file itself was created by U.S. Air Force intelligence. So somebody was clearly taking an interest in what was being said and talked about with regard to the Flatwoods Monster, to the extent that, you know, the agencies were actively collecting reports from newspapers and filing them, you know, and scrutinizing pretty much every bit of media coverage of the case. And we find that in a lot of cases where, you know, when government files start to surface, you know, people say, well, how do they obtain the information? You know, very often it is like the easiest way. You know, you buy the UFO magazines or the Monster magazines, and that's what we find, you know, that they literally went out and, you know, bought all the magazines and newspapers and got a pair of scissors and snipped them out and copied them into the file. But, you know, what's fascinating is that there should have been a file in the first place, you know, so that's... But again, it's like another classic demonstration of how when a monster sighting occurs, you know, very often a file's opened on it. And what I find intriguing about the Flatwoods case is that it didn't just sort of relate to the thing being seen. Something was seen flying through the sky before it. So again, you have you have both angles. You have the UFO angle and you have the weird creature angle, which, you know, 20 years later was going on with Stan Gordon in Pennsylvania and the military there.
But that's such a bizarre story because it's the first time that you hear of this at such an early time. We're talking 1952, to be hearing about a robotic, robotic creature. It's a strange story.
Well, it's very strange. It's made even stranger by the fact that when I was doing the research, I found additional files which talked about how, in the Second World War, the British military had come up with this plan to create, like, a 12-foot-tall... it sounds bizarre, but it's actually in the files, like a bizarre sort of scarecrow-type creature, which would have all these weird electric lights and sparks coming off it. It was designed to sort of frighten the enemy to think he's like some sort of devilish creature. So, you know, this has given rise to the idea, well, could it have been some sort of secret military experiment, you know? And so we have the military experiment angle. We have the idea that it was like some sort of alien monster, and we have the strange light in the sky and the government file. So it's like a really weird catch-all of everything, you know?
That, yeah. Okay, so we've got the military involved so far in the two different storylines. And tell us about the Minnesota Iceman and the FBI's interest in that.
Well, the Minnesota Iceman's an interesting story. It involves a man named Frank Hansen, and it goes back to the 1960s. And Hansen was somebody who used to put on these displays at state fairs where they would have, like, you know, the body of, like, a two-headed snake and, you know, a two-headed calf. And it was almost like a 1960s equivalent of the old, like, the so-called freak shows, you know, that used to exist 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. And one of the things that Hansen had on display became known as the Minnesota Iceman. And it was basically like a large, hairy, humanoid creature encased in a large block of ice. Now, the photographs that you can see of it actually doesn't look like Bigfoot. It looks more like a primitive, savage humanoid covered in hair, but something more along the lines of more like an ape-like version of Cro-Magnon man or Neanderthal man, rather than looking definitively gorilla-like or ape-like. And one of the stories is that it was supposedly shot in the Vietnam War and secretly brought back in like a military body bag, smuggled back into the U.S. for a rich millionaire who had an interest in cryptozoology and who was friends with Frank Hansen. And the story is that he supposedly allowed Frank Hansen to put it on display for a while. In the 60s, a number of cryptozoologists were actually allowed... They weren't allowed to sort of break into the ice block, but they were allowed to examine it and photograph it. One of them was a man named Bernard Heuvelman, a very well-respected cryptozoologist. And he said that as he got up close to the ice and, you know, was looking at it, he could sort of smell this putrid smell of, like, rotting flesh, which suggested, you know, it wasn't like some sort of sophisticated model, that there really was... like a once-living creature encased in the ice, you know, and the smell has started to sort of permeate through the ice. And so the story was, as I said, that it was like a semi-humanoid type creature. Now, when word got out that it may have been killed during the Vietnam War and smuggled back, and it was possibly semi-human or primitive human, then, you know, bureaucracy got involved from the line of, well, even if it's a primitive human... And it was smuggled back by the military. Does that mean a murder occurred? And the FBI actually got briefly involved in investigating it. They actually traveled out to an FBI agent visited Frank Hansen's home and said, you know, I want to see the Minnesota Iceman. And, of course, you know, Frank Hansen wasn't every day. You know, the FBI turns up on your doorstep to see, you know, a monster encased in a block of ice. So that's exactly what happened. And... so it was almost like a very surreal situation, but fortunately, the FBI man looked at it and said, well, whatever it is, you know, it doesn't look like a human, and, you know, he said the FBI's role doesn't revolve around zoological mysteries, and he said, thank you very much, goodbye, and that was it. So, you know, Hansen sort of chalked it up to a sort of experience, I guess, that, you know, when you start... putting things like this on display and they've got a controversial story behind them, you know, the official world sits up and takes notice. But in this case, it was really that they just sort of left it alone. It was, well, you know, it doesn't appear to be a human, so it's not our jurisdiction.
That's awesome. Do you have time to stay with us for a little bit longer, Nick?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great, because we've got extra time today, so we're going to take this into the next hour because I've only just begun with this fascinating story. So, good. All right, let's move on then. Keeping in this theme, though, you do talk about how the Soviet Union has been attempting to crossbreed apes and people, and I think this ties in somehow with the Bigfoot story, and I was wondering if you can make a segue to that information.
Yes, yeah, sure. Well, this involves a man named Ilya Ivanov, who was a Russian scientist who was sort of at his most active around through the 1910s and the 1920s. And he was a very brilliant scientist, but he was also like a Dr. Frankenstein type, like a real-life Dr. Frankenstein, in the sense that he had a fascination with sort of alternative science, sort of trying to push the barriers even further, but in some very controversial directions. And one thing that he wasn't so much interested in, he was obsessed with it, was the idea of trying to crossbreed humans with apes. And Ivanov was actually officially funded by the former Soviet Union's Academy of Sciences to actually see if this could be done. And the funding allowed him to travel to West Africa with a team of personnel where they captured and exercised a number of female gorillas and chimpanzees. And they impregnated them with human sperm, male sperm. And the idea was to see, you know, if you could crossbreed these creatures. Now, as far as we know, the official story is that all the experiments failed and they didn't have any success. But, you know, nature does sort of have its guidelines, if you like, which prevent sort of interspecies reproduction to, you know, prevent freakish offspring from being born. Now, that said, I mean, chimpanzees, we're actually, our DNA and chimpanzee DNA is actually 98% identical. There's only 2% DNA difference, but it's that 2% that makes us so different from chimpanzees, but 98% of the DNA is the same. So, you know, we're actually not that far away from them. So, you know, although the official story is that all these experiments failed, there are a few rumors that against all the odds, one or two of them did work, you know, and the offspring were sort of freakish, crossbred, half-human, half-ape animals that, you know, the story is that they were, you know, sort of mentally deficient and, you know, they weren't semi-human, they weren't semi-ape, they were just sort of somewhere in between. And because even though the experiments allegedly worked, you know, the story is that the, you know, it wasn't like they were, you know, they had the intelligence of people and the strength of gorillas like some Superman or anything like that. It was, you know, they were just sort of freakish-looking semi-human things, and nobody knew what to do with them. So one of the legends is that they supposedly, they didn't want to kill them because they were semi-human. So they released them into the wilds of, like, Siberia, and then afterwards people in the area saw them and assumed that they were like a wild Russian equivalent of Bigfoot, not realizing that they may have been the result of some weird experiment by Ilya Ivanov. But what we know for sure is that the experiments definitely went ahead. We know that. We actually have documents confirming that. Unfortunately, all the stuff about possibly one or two of them succeeding, you know, is sort of word of mouth and legend. It doesn't mean they didn't succeed, but it means that if they did, you know, it would have been something that was really against the odds and would have been almost like a billion to one. But, you know, a billion to one can still be a billion to one, you know. So.
Oh, God. DNA in the hands of crazy scientists is a very scary, very scary reality that we're seeing playing out now in our laboratories. We're not even seeing what they're doing, but certainly, you know, doing this and then throwing these beings out into to fend out in the wild, that is just ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like today. I mean, you know, we're doing things like gene splicing and DNA manipulation, and, you know, his was just sort of basic, you know, impregnation 80, 90
right,
years
yeah.
ago. But today, you know, that's why today, you know, there's new laws are being put in place to try and prevent sort of freakish things being created in the labs. But, I mean, when you start manipulating DNA and, you know, crossbreeding animals, you know, the big question is, you know, where is it going to end?
Right, and speaking of freakish things and laboratories, tell us about the CIA's Frankenstein-like project, as you call it, to create a creature that was half cat and half machine.
Yeah, this is a really strange story. It goes back to the 1960s, and an official CIA project had a sort of strange name of Acoustic Kitty, and it was called that because it involved, the idea was to take cats, regular cats, and insert like microphones and radio, sort of miniature radio broadcasting equipment inside their bodies. You know, just transform them in almost like a robotic cat. You know, not literally like a robot, but literally implant, you know, sort of recording devices and bugging devices inside their bodies. And the idea was, it sounds really far-fetched, and it actually didn't work out, but you'll understand why. The plan was they wanted to try and have these cats with all this sort of bugging and microphone equipment inside them and try and train them to walk around the grounds of the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C., and, you know, if there were any Russian personnel talking, you know, about classified secrets, and there was a cat walking past, you know, they wouldn't think anything of it. But the plan was, well, you know, could the cats possibly pick up snippets of conversations that would be important and, you know, that would broadcast back to CIA headquarters? You know, it sounds like a totally off-the-wall program, which it actually was. But what was kind of intriguing was that the first cat that they used actually survived the operation, the surgery, to implant these devices into its body. But unfortunately, when it was released just across the road from the Soviet embassy, and they tried to teach it, you know, to sort of cross the road, it actually got hit by a speeding taxi and killed. And so that was the end of it. And the official records have now been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act, and they actually talk about how the CIA decided to drop the project simply because it was seen as being just too complicated and unwieldy, and there were too many variables as to why it wouldn't work. But, I mean, they actually spent $10 million on developing this sort of miniaturized technology to insert into the cat that would, you know, like microphones and radio transmitters and this sort of kind of thing. And so, you know, a lot of thought and serious ideas were given to it, but it was just one of these weird programs that, you know, often gets created and for whatever reason gets shut down because it just didn't work well.
It's a pretty ridiculous idea.
Well, it is really, but, you know, I think sometimes agencies, they think outside the box in ways that are really outside the box, you know, and if they work, they continue. If they don't, they just get shelved and, you know, pushed to one side, and they become part of, you know, just sort of strange legend, if you like.
Well, on the subject of cats, I'm going to do a little leap here and ask about your report of the connection between the late Diana, Princess of Wales, and reports of large and savage cats in the countryside of Britain. What's that story?
Well, throughout Britain, for hundreds of years, but certainly more in the last century or so, there have been a lot of reports of what sound like the equivalent of American mountain lions or black leopards. Now,
yes.
There should not be anything like that running around in the wild in the UK at all. You know, the only cats in Britain are house cats. And there's just one form of wildcat, which is called the Scottish wildcat, which lives in Scotland. But that's only roughly the same size as a normal cat. It's just a bit more fierce because they live in the wild, so they're not tame. But they look just like normal cats. And yet every year we get hundreds of reports of people seeing things, the color and the size, as I said, of what look like mountain lions or black leopards. Now, this particular story is a very strange one. It came from a friend of mine named John Downs, and John runs a full-time organization in Britain that investigates strange creatures, and he was contacted in the late 1980s by a now-retired British soldier who was part of a military detachment. He was attached to British Army Intelligence, and the Army Intelligence had got word of a story that there was some sort of hostile group was going to try and either kidnap or assassinate Princess Diana. So the military set up like this small unit, you know, highly trained group who were, you know, highly trained in weaponry, etc., to protect the princess in the event that somebody did try to kidnap her or assassinate her. And to really keep the secret so the press didn't find out, etc., they didn't even tell Diana. She didn't know anything about it, apparently, but she was being shadowed by this military unit, and neither did the rest of the royal family. So they basically kept at a distance. Wherever she went, you know, they would stay in the background and just follow in vans and things like that to make sure nothing happened to her. And on one occasion, she was visiting a house in Devonshire, which is down in the southwest of England. It's like a very wild moorland-type area, and it's actually where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle set his Sherlock Holmes novel, The Hound of the Baskerville. So it's like a creepy, foggy area of moorland, which looks just like he did a couple of hundred years ago, even today. And the house where Diana was visiting, the military set up like a little unit about 100 yards away where they could watch the house through night scope equipment and night vision equipment, that sort of thing, to make sure, you know, that no kidnappers or whatever storm the house. And as they were watching it, as John was told by this retired soldier, this huge black cat sort of prowled around the front of the... And they said there was no way, you know, you could mistake this for just like an overfed house cat. You know, it was like the body was like 6 feet long.
Wow.
Very powerful, muscular legs and a big, big neck and body. And, you know, the military unit, they were expecting to have to deal with, you know, terrorists or kidnappers. They weren't expecting to see, like, a six-foot-long, marauding big cat. And they didn't know, you know, if they shot at it, it would give the game away that they were watching Diana, and then the story would come tumbling out, et cetera, et cetera. So they did probably the only thing they could do. They didn't do anything, and they just hoped the cat would go away. And eventually it did, and it sort of just ambled off onto the moors. Presumably, you know, it was looking around this little old village for food, you know, small animals like foxes and rabbits and things, and it didn't find anything and headed off to the moors. But John said that this whole thing was subject to, as the soldier related to him, the whole thing was subject to official secrecy purely and simply because the issue of Diana being watched, that in itself was a national security issue because of the threats made to her. And then when the cat came into view, well, they had to hide the story of the cat because if that came out, then the people would be asking, well, why were the military there in the first place? So then the Diana thing would come out. So by default, if you like, you know, the government actually censored the story about a big cat on the loose for national security reasons, but actually which had bearing on the royal family itself, you know, rather than just on the cat. So it was, in other words, there were like two mysteries involved. You know, you had the conspiracy with Diana, and then you had the secrecy where they didn't want to alarm the public that there was a big cat on the loose.
And was there ever any question that this was some kind of interdimensional being?
So you broke up a bit then as to what?
Was there ever a question that it was some sort of interdimensional creature, or did they believe it was a physical?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because they felt it was a totally physical animal. But there are a number of reports in the UK of big cats, and also a number of researchers who do believe these things have more sort of paranormal overtones to them than they do flesh and blood type animals. Because, as I said, there should not be anything like this in the UK. But the sheer number of reports we get every year, you know, and they go back actually centuries, not just decades, you know, it's kind of like Bigfoot. We just We just don't get bodies of them. And that's, you know, some people have suggested, could they be like a paranormal type thing? For example, you know, 300-400 years ago in Britain, you used to get a lot of reports of what were called phantom black dogs, where people would see like large black dogs with glowing red eyes, and if you saw one, it was like a precursor to, like an omen of death or tragedy or something like that. And that's actually where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle got the idea for the Hound of the Baskervilles, because he actually read one of these stories, and decided to sort of use that as a basis for his novel. And some people think the big cats are kind of like a modern-day paranormal equivalent of the 17th century black or 16th century black dogs. So, or maybe it's a combination of two. You know, maybe there's a paranormal angle, but some of them are flesh and blood also. You know.
And it sounds pretty strange that black panthers are roaming around the English countryside.
Well, it does. I mean, we do know that some cases people did own them. You could actually own them prior to 1976 in the UK without any sort of license at all. Then in 1976, the government passed what was called the Dangerous Wild Animals Act, and you had to have a permit, which cost a lot of money. You had to prove the animal was held in a secure building. And there are some stories about people who said they couldn't afford the permits, and they couldn't afford, you know, to build this very secure place, so they took their animals out into the wood at night and released them. But the problem is, most people who said, there's only a handful of people who said this, they did this, but those who did release them, you know, they mainly released them just one at a time. You know, it wasn't like a male and female that would mate. And, of course, the other big problem is we have lots of reports that predate the claims about people releasing them. You know, reports actually go back to, like, the 1700s. And, again, you know, a country the size of Britain, which is only, like, 800 miles long, you know, with hundreds of reports a year, we should at least be finding one body, you know, of one of these creatures, but we're not. And as I said, there are a few paranormal-type reports where people said the creature sort of vanished, and, I mean, literally vanished, you know, not rather than run off or whatever.
Oh, boy, how intriguing. I have so many questions for you, it's just ridiculous. And I really want to remind people that are listening that this book is beautifully titled The Monster Files, and this is a compendium information that may not be there in the future. So I would imagine that this is one of those books you're going to, if cryptology intrigues you in the minimal, or if anything that you've heard so far fascinates you, you're going to want to have this book, I don't want to say before it's pulled, but definitely. This is an author who has done his homework, and these are actual files of record information. So you want to get it, and not that we're signing out yet, but just remember, we're talking with Nick Redfern, and the book in question is The Monster Files. Monster Files. I also wanted to ask you about the Loch Ness Monster, and, of course, many of us are very familiar. I think that the audience listening now is familiar with the Loch Ness Monster story. Is there anything new that you've discerned from the files from the British government?
Well, the British files that have surfaced on the Loch Ness Monster are more sort of historical. They go back to through the 1960s and the 1980s. But, I mean, in terms of modern-day stuff, you know, government stuff aside, we still get reports, you know. I mean, every year there are sort of, you know, 10, 15 reported sightings, which may not sound a lot, but if you consider that if these creatures exist, which I think they do, you know, and they derive their oxygen from the water like fish, then for the most part they wouldn't need to surface, you know, and if they were mammals like us, you know, they'd be surfacing all the time to breathe. So I think this is a good indication that, you know, that they spend all their time under the water for the most part, so they would have to be some sort of fish, you know, otherwise they'd drown, you know, they'd be like us. So the small number of sightings, I think, is an indication they're not mammals and they are probably some sort of fish. But nevertheless, we do get reports every year. Now, and sightings, recorded sightings, go back about 1,500 years, which is when we have the first report. So there's clearly a long tradition of sightings of something. The big question is what? But through the British Freedom of Information Act, we have a number of files, some of them where we had British military, British Royal Air Force, which is the equivalent of the US Air Force, where their photo analysts actually studied a number of photographs and film footage purporting to show strange creatures in Loch Ness. They carefully studied, you know, with various scientific equipment, etc., this footage and so on, in the 60s, and actually came to the conclusion that what was filmed, you know, they weren't seals or they weren't like sturgeon or small boats or anything like that, or wave formations. They actually concluded that in some cases they appeared to be animate, large creatures, somewhere in the region like 12 to 15 feet long. And, you know, there shouldn't be anything that long swimming in English lakes anywhere, you know, 12 to 15 feet. So, you know, when you've got sort of military photo analysts making that conclusion, then that is sort of highly significant. The other files from the 1980s, they talk about how the government spent a lot of time secretly trying to figure out if they could train dolphins to be released into Loch Ness. And the plan was to have sort of cameras and sonar equipment attached to them and try and train the dolphins to sort of swim as long and as deep as they could, and to see if they could actually, you know, stumble upon these creatures and film them or take photographs. So the cameras, you know, would be running continuously. And eventually the whole thing was shelved because it was seen as sort of too unwieldy to try and get the dolphins into Loch Ness, but then afterwards try and encourage them to come back to shore and, you know, be placed in a, you know, a water-filled cage or whatever and transferred out of the loch. But so, you know, that was seen as the big problem. But, you know, it was sort of fascinating to discover that the British government actually planned, you know, and they came up with how the cameras would be strapped to the dolphins and how the sonar equipment to record the movements would be attached to them as well. And, you know, it was also a brilliantly thought-out plan. As I said, the only stumbling block was training the dolphins to actually come back when the project was over, so...
Right, like, so long, and thanks for all the fish.
Oh, they'd love it in there. I mean, you know, I mean, it's full of fish, so, you know, they'll be well at home.
Nick, I wanted to get into Men in Black, and we certainly have a little bit more time, but I'm not sure if it's such a big subject in itself, but because of the supernatural or alien connection to some of the things you've talked about today, I was wondering if you could just give us some insight into your understanding of what that is all about, because we have some people believe that these are actual beings that are slipping in and out of some kind of time warp, and others believe that they are alien.
I've written two books on the Men in Black. I'm actually working on a third one now because I literally get so many reports, you know, that's to where, you know, there's so much information to share. And when you think of Men in Black, everybody thinks of the movies, you know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. But in reality, you know, the real reports are very different. You know, people, if you talk about the Men in Black, people think, oh, you've been watching the movies too much, you know. But most people don't realize that the Men in Black movies were actually based on a comic book series of the same name. And the comic books were inspired by real-life reports, which go back to the 1940s. I mean, the term Men in Black was actually coined in the early 1950s. That's how long it's been around. And there have been, somewhere in the region, probably about 20 books written on the subject since then. But unlike in the movies, the real Men in Black are described as being very different, you know, to the movie equivalent, where they're all, in the movies, you know, they're like secret agents of this classified arm of government. In the real-life report, the Men in Black are sort of very creepy-looking. They're only sort of like 5 feet to 5 feet tall, very pale skin, looking very, almost like anemic and anorexic. And they have sort of like this ghoulish vampire kind of aspect to them, where, you know, they're perceived as very menacing, and they often, you know, they'll turn up late on the doorsteps of UFO witnesses' homes, and, you know, they'll knock on the door at like 11 o'clock, you know, and people open the door and contrary to what you might think, they don't force their way in. They stand there waiting to be invited in, which kind of ties in with the mythology about vampires. You know, they won't cross the threshold unless they're invited, and that's what the Men in Black are like. And a lot of people have said, you know, you suddenly knock on your door at midnight or something, you open, you saw three little creepy white-faced men in black suits and black fedora hats, you wouldn't let them in. You'd probably call the police, but most people, they do let them in. It's almost like, as a number of witnesses have said, they felt their minds were almost controlled or in like a hypnotic state, and these creatures or entities would come in and then interrogate them about their UFO encounter and then suddenly just get up and leave. But because they look so weird and act so weird, this has given rise to a number of theories. You have the idea that they're aliens themselves. Other people believe they could be like time travelers, you know, from the future, because, you know, they wear sort of old style clothing. You know, the theory is that they're coming back and they've kind of got the fashions wrong slightly, you know, for the period in which they turn up. And then you have another theory, which is like the occult theory, the idea that they're something sort of definitively supernatural, you know. Because what's weird, there are a number of cases where people have seen the Men in Black and afterwards they've experienced like violent outbreaks of poltergeist activity and so like psychic ghostly stuff in the home. And there are even some people who think they're like literally demonic, you know, literally demonic. So you have lots of different theories as to what they might be, but whatever they are, you know, they're very sort of very creepy, and everybody said that, you know, that sees them talks about these things having oozing almost like this sense of dread and like negativity, if you like.
I had an experience. Would you like to hear about it?
Yeah, sure.
When I was in the crop circle, the Julia set in 1996, which was the big, big one. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a revolutionary experience in the phenomenon of the crop circle. I had an out-of-body journey that was really life-changing. And when I came back in, I lost 2 hours of time. And when I came back in, I was trying to cope with being there and getting out and getting back to the car. I was accompanied by a professor. He went to get the car, and I was walking out of the field, and I ran across these two characters that were very robotic. They were very pale. They walked in synchronicity with each other. One of them was carrying a weird-looking briefcase, and it was he carried it out far. His arm was not in the right position to be carrying a briefcase. It looked like it was heavy. His arm was sticking out. And they looked at me together robotically, and it was very menacing. And then they looked away, and they kept walking. And they were dressed in the wrong time frame, too. The classic thing. And I had never heard about Men in Black at that time.
Wow.
So I saw the black sedan parked out there. And I remember walking out saying to the farmer's wife who held the money box, "Boy, a lot of strange looking people here." And she looked at me like, "Yeah." But
they had like the black suit and, you mean?
They had the black suit and the whole, and they had I remember thinking, how odd to see a Chevy sedan in the middle of England, because even back in 96, it was still, you didn't see big cars in England, did you?
No, everybody wheel drives small cars in Britain. I mean, to see a Chevy, you know, people be doing double takes to see like a black Chevy going down the road, you know.
Right, and of course, because I'm from the States, it was something that really captured my attention. That like, what is that gigantic Chevy Biscayne doing in the middle of the crop field?
And did they have the hats on as well, or not?
Yeah.
Oh, well. And did they say anything to you?
No, but they looked at me, and the look was just like, it was just very menacing. And I had had this blissful experience in the formation. So this was when I was coming out. And and the thing that's interesting is that this memory was cloaked to me for a few months. And then suddenly I remembered it.
Wow. That's interesting you should say that, because a lot of people who see the Men in Black, they get this strange feeling that, you know, when they're sat opposite them, there's something menacing about them, where even before they start talking, it's as if they give off this atmosphere or air of, like as I said earlier, like negativity. And the people have said, you know, that they can tell there's something sort of evil or not right about them. And one witness said that the man in black sort of looked at them in the kind of the way that a dog's eyes go wide when it's about to bite, you know, or lunge at you. And, you know, most people have said that they see these MIB and there's something really frightening about them, but they're not sure why. But it's just that they give off this sort of very strange atmosphere.
It was menacing. The feeling that I got was that they were letting me know that whatever I had experienced was to go no further. It was like they were some kind of patrol units of the paranormal or something.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing that some people do think that, you know, they're sort of dispatched, if you like, or sent out to prevent us getting too close to the truth about, you know, this or that. And I think there may be something to that, because although a lot of people, probably most people, associate the men in black with UFOs, they do turn up in other cases. You know, there are reports of Bigfoot witnesses being silenced by men in black type creatures. There are people who've engaged in sort of Ouija boards and investigating things like that. And the further they've gone into it, they've got visits. So it's almost like, as some people do believe, you know, whatever the MIB are, they sort of patrol or they police, you know, the whole paranormal realm. But for the most part, you know, we just hear about it in relation to UFOs.
Yeah, there were other people who later on, also I found out that other people as well had seen them there. So it wasn't just directed at me, but it was unsettling. I can assure you that you'd rather not run into them.
No, I mean, everybody says that, but, you know, they just, that sort of give you the creeps, you know?
Yeah, the creeps, that's the word.
Yeah.
Well, you are certainly a master of handling running into the creeps in all the work that you do. You've got a wonderful body of work, Nick. We could go on and on, but I know it's been an hour and a half now, so I'm going to release you back to the wild, as you say.
All right. Well, I appreciate having me on the show, Pat. Thank you.
Thank you for being back, Nick. It's really a pleasure. You are a wonderful reservoir of knowledge for the world. And I just want to remind everybody that I have been speaking with the fascinating Nick Redfern. His book, his website, nickredfern.com. His many books. I think that by now you know that you're going to want to read this information. So the latest is Monster Files. Get a hold of this and keep it in your library, I'm telling you. And with that, I'm going to say good night, or on my side of the world, it's good morning. It is Dolphin Land where I am, and my getting up at this hour means I'm going to rush out to the waterfront for the sunrise and hopefully see some spouts out there. So thank you all. This is Patricia Corey. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you, implores you, to think outside the box of convention. And we have most definitely done that today with Nick. Thanks a lot. Be with me next week in my morning show at 11 a.m. And I have the always controversial Alfred Weber, Exopolitics, will be talking about transhumanism. So put that on your calendar as well. Thank you. Goodbye. This is Patricia Corey signing out. Nanu, nanu.
Don't go away just yet. Coming up at the top of the hour, Beyond the Matrix with Patricia Corey, that's me, for people who think outside the box. And I know that's you, so stay with us. In just a few minutes, we'll be on with Beyond the Matrix.